Well, hello. Today I am here with my good friend Rick Salmon. Rick, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Chris. You know, you just do an amazing job with everything you do, with your photography, with Out of Chicago, Out of New York. And I know we're talking about doing another Out of Something. So I think your listeners and your viewers and your members, they're going to be really excited about that.
Well, thank you, Rick. And it's been great to get to know you and to work with so many great photographers. And we're super excited to have you coming to the Out of New York conference coming up in October.
I can't wait for that. There was so much energy. I mean, so much, you know, great energy at Out of Chicago. You know, it was from the moment I came into the room as a keynote speaker to the end when Scott Bourne was the ending speaker. You know, throughout that whole show, there was so much energy, and it starts at the top. So congratulations to you.
Well, thank you very much. So I hope you guys join us Out of New York. But today we are talking about, we're going to talk about one of your favorite places to shoot, I believe, right? We're going to talk about Africa today. Is that right, Rick?
Yeah, we're going to talk about, you know, going on safari. And I've been to Africa 4 or 5 times. And I've been to Tanzania, I've been to Kenya, I've been to South Africa, and I've been to Botswana. And each country is a little bit different. If you want to see thousands, I mean, wake up in the morning and see thousands and thousands of animals, Kenya and Tanzania are the place to go, are the places to go. But if you want to get up close and personal with the animals, I would recommend going to Botswana and South Africa, because in most of these camps, you can drive off the roads and you can get, like I said, up close and personal with the animals and get these portraits and to get these action shots that you can get in Kenya. But in Kenya, what happens if there's a kill, if there's some action, all the drivers get on the radios and there's like, you know, 37 vehicles around watching the same thing. But in Botswana, where I did a workshop this year, I'm doing 2 workshops actually there in 2018 in Botswana and South Africa. It is different. You can get really close, and it's magical. It's magical to be this close one-on-one with a wild animal.
How many times do you think you've been to Africa?
I've been 4 or 5 times. I think I've lost track. I don't even know where my... Well, we are going to Sri Lanka in October. It's been 5 times. The first time we went on a very, very tight budget. My wife and I basically slept in... Susan, who you know, slept in a pup tent. And now we stay in a pretty nice camp. So hard work pays off for sure.
Yeah. Well, so today we're going to talk about, you talked a little bit about your favorite places. We're going to talk a little bit about equipment to bring. And also we're going to top it all off with an interview with a friend of yours is Jonathan Scott. He's a big cat guy. Tell us a little bit about him.
Jonathan Scott, I talk about my son to you a lot, right? I talk about him in my presentations. And I think about if my son could only meet a few of my friends, who would they be? And Jonathan Scott is one of them. He's such a gentleman. He's such a nice man. He's so passionate about what he and his wife, Angie, do, their team. They live in, they might be moving to the United States, but they live in Nairobi now, and they actually have a cottage on the Maasai Mara where I've taken many, many of my Africa pictures. But he's such a nice man. He's so knowledgeable about wildlife, but he's also an excellent photographer. And he's a cannon shooter like myself. So, you know, when I was there the last time, I think you saw the picture, we're both using that Canon 200 to 400 millimeter image stabilization lens with the 1.4x converter in it. Mm-hmm. Which is an amazing lens. But the last time I went to Africa, I left that behind. Actually, I didn't rent it. And I used the Canon 100 to 400. Have you tried the new 100 to 400, the twist?
I have used it a couple of times. It is amazing. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's so sharp. So I'm using that with a 1.4x converter, because when you go to Africa, one of the tips is that you really want to travel light because when you get there's weight restrictions on the planes. So you really want to bring, you know, not so many clothes, and you want to think about your gear very, very carefully and the backup gear that you want to bring. Like, you always need a backup camera.
Right. Not necessarily out in the field. Do you always bring a backup in the field or just on your trip?
Always in the field. Because if something happens, you know, who knows what could happen. But when you see a shot like a lion, I'm looking at my gallery right now. And if people want to see some of my recent Botswana pictures, they could go on ricksalmon.com, click on galleries. And the first gallery up there is a 2016 safari. I mean, I would be sad if I didn't have any of these pictures, any of them,
right.
if I had missed them, whether it's a sunset or a lion yawning or a leopard, you know, staring right at me, or these leopard cubs. It's you always have to have a backup, always have extra batteries, because you're going to be shooting a lot. You know, usually I say don't use the spray and pray approach. But when it comes to, you know, like a giraffe running across the Mara or Botswana, the plains in Botswana, you want to go for those little nuances, like the position of the legs is very, very important. So the animal looks very graceful.
Yeah,
so you take a lot of pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people have said that to me about some of my just street images, and maybe I'm wrong, but you know, they'll say, wow, you timed it perfectly. I was like, no, I took 10 of them and picked the best right. one.
Well, there's a joke. It says one of the differences, Chris, between a professional photographer and an amateur is the professional doesn't have to show his or her own bad shots.
That's so right.
I show my bad shots, you know, in my books, the good and the bad, but, you know, as a way of teaching. But in wildlife photography, you do want that high frame rate. And actually, getting back to my site, I have a gallery on the Mara. You'll see a Jonathan Scott there. He and I are on a Land Rover playing with our 200 to 400 millimeter lenses.
So when you go back, you're not going to do the 200 to 400. That's probably weighs 3 or 4 times as much as the 100 to 400, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to bring that. It's a great lens. It's an awesome lens. It's tack sharp. But for what I do, you know, we're shooting from a movie, from a vehicle, and the animals are moving around. We're getting close. And most people, I think, are surprised for the first time they go to Africa in a place like Botswana or South Africa, and in the Mara too, how close the Masai Mara, how close you can actually get to the animals. You don't need, like, you know, in most cases, you know, some people bring like an 800 millimeter lens, or on the last workshop I led there, someone brought a 400-28. You don't need the 400-28. You could, you know, you could blur the background if you want that in Photoshop.
And you say that you're close. I wonder, maybe some people are worried. Are you ever worried for your safety when you're there?
No, because the guides are so good. These guides, not only do they know the animal species, they know the individual animals, like Jonathan Scott. You know, he was the host of the Big Cat Diaries on TV. You know, for many, many years. And if the if your listeners want to check it out, they could go on YouTube. A lot of the episodes, Big Cat Diaries, are there. We'll and they actually had names for the lions and the lion cubs. And they got to know the lions. But the guides, you know, you're in a vehicle, and the guides, they're first and foremost, they think about safety. You know, sometimes actually, we were there and I wanted to get out of the vehicle to get a shot. And the guy says, no, the elephants, too many elephants here. Do not, I'm sorry, but you can't get out of the car, out of the vehicle. But there was one situation where these giraffes were just posed on the top of this mountain at sunset. They were backlit. It was gorgeous. I said, could I get out? And the guide said, sure, it's safe. So listen to the guides is another tip.
Yeah. So you're not just showing up, getting off the plane and running out there. You're with guides. You're on an actual safari, right?
Yes. We're on a safari and in a safari vehicle. And, you know, I talk about this. I have a new book. I have a new book coming out. It might actually be out by the time this is up. It's called Evolution of an Image.
And I feel like you just had your other one, your creative visualization just came out. What's this new one? What number? How many is this for you?
Well, that's 37.
37. That's what I thought.
And, you know, I actually like writing books. It gives me something to do on the plane. I love sharing. And it's a good way to organize your thoughts. And it's a good way, you know, to pick your pictures, I think. And then, you know, it helps me pick my favorite pictures. And then, like I said before, I show my good and my bad pictures. And, you know, by doing that, I learn. So I learn a lot. Actually, there's an expression, if you want to become an expert on something, write a book about it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And or just teach it, because that's how I've always felt, that I was teaching physics, and it wasn't until I started to teach it to other people that I really understood it. And now I'm starting to teach photography, and it's just making me understand it that much better.
Oh, yeah. And I know you're a great teacher. But getting back to Jonathan Scott and the vehicle, in my book and in my presentations when I show my pictures, I tell people that for these Masai Mara pictures, I only take 25% of the credit. I get 25% for taking the picture. Jonathan gets 25% because he loaned me a safari vehicle, like with a little balcony on it.
That, yeah, I remember the pictures of that, yeah.
That he used to use in Big Cat Diaries. Our guide, Simon, man, he took us to, he got me in the best possible positions every time for the light in the background. It's amazing what this man knows. And then Susan gets 25% for helping me switch cameras and lenses. So I only get, I'm serious. I only take 25% because I would never have gotten all these pictures if it wasn't for all the help I get. And I think it's important for photographers to tell people that. So when they look at, you know, I have a picture of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cubs walking around two female lions.
That's my favorite image of yours.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you very much.
I love it.
And they all have their eyes open, which is kind of lucky. But anyway, because the lines blink a lot because of the flies, very shallow depth of field. But I never would have gotten that picture without all the help.
Yeah, well, and basically what you're offering, if you're doing a workshop, you said you have them coming up in 2018, is everything you just mentioned, the guides, every, you know, and you, your expertise and everything you need. It's all sign up and away you go. It's everything you need for the tour, right?
Plus processing, you know, there's a lot of downtime, believe it or not, on safari. You get up like in the dark because you want to be out. You want to be out before the sun comes up. So you're out there before the sun comes up. Then around 9 o'clock, maybe 10 o'clock, the light is so harsh. It's not good for pictures, really, unless you're shooting maybe infrared. And you want to take some pictures of animals in the shade. So then you're back at the camp and you don't go out again till 4 o'clock, you know, again, when the light starts to get nice. So during that downtime on the workshops, we process our pictures and we download our pictures to make sure we have them. And I'd like to share another tip. You have the Canon 5D Mark III, right?
That's right.
Well, I'm shooting with that. I also have the new 5D Mark IV, which is amazing. Do you always shoot with two cards?
Oh, you're going to say that I should. No, I don't.
Okay. Well, I didn't. I just use the compact flash cards up until this March on our Botswana safari. Everything's going great for 5 or 6 days. On the 7th day, we see this beautiful encounter. Again, these lions with the cubs, and they're rolling around and they're licking each other. And it's just such a beautiful sight. So I come back, put my card in my card reader, can't read, doesn't even recognize it, put it back in my camera, doesn't even recognize it. So I sent it to Lexar and they were able to recover it. So I have my pictures and Lexar is an amazing company. I use their cards all the time. So I think this was human error. I think I took the card out. I think I didn't turn the camera off, press the shutter release button and pull the card out, you know, pop the card out while it was writing to it. So anyway, after that, I always shoot with two cards, especially in, I just always shoot with two cards. Yeah. It never happened again.
and you set it so that it's writing to both cards at the same time.
Both cards at the same time. So that does slow you down, right? If you're shooting, you know, the raw files to both, but you could shoot JPEGs to one, but I shoot the raw files to both. Just because you just don't know.
You never know. That's right. So I think you mentioned in there something about the new 5D Mark IV. You're a Canon guy, so you've got it before anyone else. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I took this to Iceland. This is August. No, this is September. Mm-hmm. I was a 3-week. I lose track of where I go. Thank God for my Mac calendar and Susan. Anyway, we were in Iceland about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I got a chance to shoot with this. It's the autofocus is faster. There's a new switch on the back. There's an autofocus, like a auto select feature where you could move the focus around much faster, right, on the subject. This is actually my favorite feature. I forget the exact name of it, but it's really, do you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know what it's called, but yeah, there's like a whole new button back there. And I'm like, what the heck is that all about?
That's what this is. This lets you change the focus zones and the focus points much faster. But I was photographing a lot of waterfalls, and I think they should change the name to Iceland to Waterfall Land because
right.
There's actually more water. Well, there's a lot of ice in the winter and there's a lot of ice there. But anyway, so I'm photographing at slow shutter speeds. I'm photographing all these beautiful waterfalls. I have one on the homepage of my site right now. And if it's not on the homepage, when your listeners want, actually, it's called Landscape Photography, Analyze This. And what this post is about is I analyze this landscape photo. But anyway, I'm shooting at like a 1.3 second exposure. I'm looking for what I know was a long exposure. And so the water's nice and beautifully blurred, that cottony, silky look. And I have detail in the water, and I have detail in the shadow areas. So I don't know exactly if the dynamic range is better than the 5D Mark III, but I'm finding that I have to do less when it comes to opening up the shadows and toning down the highlights.
Yeah. So just to hit a couple other features, it's like 30, it's over 30 megapixels, I think, right?
It's a, yes, it, that's correct.
Like 30.4. Go ahead. Right.
So, you know, I think I talked about this to you once. I have OCD.
Okay.
Obsessive cropping disorder.
Yes, exactly. Me too.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. And so now with this, my obsessive cropping disorder, it's perfect because I have a bigger file. I can crop in more so I can make a bigger print.
Right.
So that's a cool feature. And the HDR, I like to shoot the HDR for landscapes and outdoor stuff and waterfalls. I like to use the HDR feature 0+2-2 and the Art Vivid mode. And under certain conditions, it doesn't look like HDR. Hmm. And if it's a little too saturated, which can happen with the Art Vivid mode, I reduce the saturation just a little bit. But the cameras, the autofocus is faster. If you ever go there, and if your listeners ever go there, you have to photograph these Icelandic horses. These Icelandic horses are just gorgeous.
Well, you know, we'll do a whole podcast just on going to Iceland then. How's that?
Well, and let's do it from Iceland.
Even better. Okay. I love it.
I've been there 5 times. So,
wow. Yep. Yeah. So let's get back to Africa just a little bit. You said that, so I'm thinking if you're going to go there in 2018, you're going to have your new 5D Mark IV, you're going to have the new 100 to 400. And what other lenses would you bring?
I always have and actually there's a new 24 to 105. Canon has a new 24 to 105.
And I know that's both of our favorite lens too. So that's exciting.
Well, I think you're going to like this one because... Even more because it's coated a little differently, so it should be a little sharper, you know, throughout the f-stop range. You're going to get less flare for sure.
Which is important for me doing night photography, shooting in the lights down in the city for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right, because the light's coming through your lens. Mm-hmm. And I know the camera's weather sealing is a little better. I'm not sure about that lens. But if you go on my site here, on my galleries, and on my, where is it? It's called again, on the Mara. Here it is, on the Mara. You'd be surprised how many of these pictures were taken with the 24 to 105. Because I like, again, you can get close. You can get very close to the animals. And if you just do a bunch of headshots, you know, you could go to the zoo, right?
Right.
Maybe just go to the zoo and get a headshot. So I do take, you know, the tight head shots. I like those shots. But you mentioned that shot of the two lionesses with the cubs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like what I call or what's called an environmental shot, environmental portrait. So the 24 to 105 is fantastic. Actually, 1, 2, 3. There's about 10 pictures on this page that were taken with the 24 to 105.
Yeah. And that's, I'm really looking forward to trying the new one too. So you'll have your 100, 400, 24 to 105. Will you bring a wide angle to Africa as well?
Yeah, I always have my 17 to 40, but now there's a new 16 to 35, which I'm getting. But one of the sharpest zooms that Canon makes is a 70 to 300. They make a 70 to 300 millimeter lens.
That's what I have, the L lens, right?
Yeah, that L lens, that's super sharp. So again, who knows what could happen? The vehicle could go over a bump and lens could get knocked. So if you have the 100 to 400, I don't want to say the 70 to 300 is a backup, but sometimes... You know, I shoot with that more so than the 100 to 400 because it's smaller and lighter.
Yeah, and it just folds up. I mean, the length of it is almost the size of the 24 to 105. It's not much longer when you put it in your bag.
Yeah, I love that lens. So two bodies, and those are the main lenses that I'll bring. I probably because Susan helps me out so much, I'll bring a backup 100 to 400.
Well, she'll appreciate that.
Well, yeah, she's such a good sport and such a great assistant.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's awesome to have her. So, here's a question I have. You're on safari, you're in this Jeep, and you're shooting with these, some of them sort of heavy lenses. Are you using something to like, you're not using a tripod, monopod, leading on the Jeep? What are you doing?
When I'm by myself, when Susan and I went to the Morrow with Jonathan Scott, and again, I think your listeners are really going to enjoy the interview that I did with him. He's such a wonderful person. I'm shooting with my camera because I had a balcony there on the side. I'm shooting with my camera on a tripod. And when we do Botswana, the man I do the... Kevin Dooley, the man I do the trips with, he rents, you know, gimbal heads on beanbags that you could put on the side. Some people like to bring beanbags. But if you're in a vehicle, you know, usually in a vehicle with several other people, I find that hand holding for me works great. I'm looking at my 2016 Safari Gallery. Every single one of these pictures is a handheld shot. Every single one.
All right. So with that 100 to 400, really good image stabilization, you just handhold and you're good.
Well, yeah. But you do ask people not to move around in the vehicle, right?
Okay. Well, I've never done it. I don't know.
No, this is a good thing. You say, okay, we're shooting and let's, no sudden movements. You know, if someone, you know, gets up and moves and shakes because the action can come and go very fast. But you do brace your elbow on the side of the vehicle. And oh, here's another tip. These vehicles have rows of seats, and every row, the row behind a row is a little higher than the row in front of it. So by the time you get to the back, you might be 3 feet higher or 4 feet higher than the person in the front row. You're going to get the best shots the lower you are because you're more eye to eye with the animals. If you're up high, it's like you're shooting down, again, like you're at the zoo. Mm-hmm. So I recommend, you know, trying to get down as low as possible.
Oh, that's great advice. And that's the idea of that little balcony that you have out on that other
Jeep. That's the idea of the little balcony, right?
Yeah, that is cool. So give me also a tip. I love the photos you have, the close-ups and the groups of families, but give me a tip for shooting in Africa because my other favorite photos that you have are the sunsets with the trees and the giraffes. And how do you get that shot?
Right. Well, that's the shot. The shot you're talking about, I'm looking at, there's two giraffes. There's a tree, and I'm looking right into the sun. There's a little bit of a story behind it. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, these giraffes were in a valley. And we're at the top of the hill where this picture was taken. And I said to our guide, Bashi, I would love, can we just hang out and wait for the giraffes to come up? You know, maybe they'll go up to the top of the mountain. He says, no, Rick, I'll take care of it. So for 2 hours, he's just driving slowly around, not harassing the giraffes, just driving slowly around so the giraffes move to the top of the mountain. So they get to the top of the mountain, and this is the time where I said, can I get out? So I jump out, and I position myself so I have what separation in the photograph. Every element in this photograph is separated. You mentioned my book before. Create a visualization. I have a whole chapter on composition, but after that, I have a whole chapter on separation. Mm-hmm. So I'm moving back and forth trying to get these animals and the sun and the tree isolated and separated. So the picture, you're looking into the sun. The sun's a perfect, well, there's no such thing as a perfect circle. As a physics teacher, you know this, right? But it's a circle. And there's no like bleeding around it. So it looks just like the sun. So my tip there is really expose for the highlights. And when you're shooting into the sun, you want to underexpose enough so the sun doesn't look like a blob in the picture. You want a very distinct circle. So this is one of the few situations where I will go on manual. Most of my other pictures are taken on the aperture priority mode. I will go on manual and keep underexposing so I have that perfect not perfect. So I have this a circle. Now, the color wasn't that good there at this time. So I use an orange gradual filter in Nik Color FX Pro to add the kind of the color that you would see on a very dusty day at sunset. So it's about making the picture. And this is actually the one picture that I wanted to leave with. I wanted to get a picture that said Africa. And this picture says Africa. And it's not only because of the giraffes, but that intense orange, the color that I have seen, but I didn't see there.
Yeah, no, I love those. I even love the images you have. There's just a tree even, because they're you don't see that here. They're amazing trees that you get out on there.
Oh, the trees? Yeah, and there's a little bit of a sun popping in there.
Exactly. Yeah,
you have to shoot with your histogram on. You have to shoot with your highlight alert on. That's, you know, people say, you know, to me, Rick, do you use a light meter? And I say yes and no. No, I don't use a handheld light meter, but I use a light meter that's in my camera, which is the histogram and the highlight alert.
Right. Man, what I love about the story, the moving the Jeep around and the giraffes moving to the top, is that, you know, a lot of people out there might be thinking, hey, I'm just going to go on a safari. I'll bring my camera. It'll be great. But in that case, they probably would have wanted to be as close to the giraffes as possible just to see them. But this is a photography safari. It's meant to get great photos. And so it's a totally different experience.
Yeah. And you have to really visualize the end result. If you're looking at this 2016 Safari Gallery, those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sunset pictures were taken within like maybe 20 minutes of each other. And they're all different,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the light rays, with the different trees. So I'm zooming in, I'm zooming out, I'm trying to tell a different story. And then watching the background, of course, is very, very important.
Yeah, well, I love it. I hope to join you someday in Africa. That would be great. Maybe they might not allow us to use a name, but Out of Africa, what do you think?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but as long as it's not a movie, you know, I do an Out of Africa workshop in Fossil Rim every year in Texas. I'm doing one for Canon late in 2017. So, you know, I think as long as, if you had like the Out of Africa deli, you'd be fine. I'm
yeah.
serious.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. Yeah, the trademark.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. So that's great. You want to introduce Jonathan then? Let's get to the interview, because I think that's what most people really want to hear here.
Well, Jonathan Scott, again, I find I like people I respect. And I really respect Jonathan for being so dedicated. You know, I tell people my specialty is not specializing. Well, he specializes in big cats, but also in wildlife in Africa. And his love, his passion, he and Angie, his wife, their love and their passion for the wildlife. And I do say love is just contagious. It's infectious. It's like you're there. You're like on the TV show when you're hanging out with Jonathan Scott. So he shares some of his philosophies in the interview. He has two books coming out, an autobiography, one and another book called Sacred Nature. Like me, he likes to keep busy. So I think, let's take a listen to the interview and then we'll come back.
All right. Perfect. Sounds good.
Jonathan Scott, the big cat man, welcome to the show and welcome to the United States. How are you?
Rick, it's lovely to hear your voice. It reminds me of when you and Susan visited with us that time in September in the Masai Mara, which is in Kenya, our second home and big cat country.
That is such a special place. And we were there for the migration. I mean, seeing thousands and thousands and thousands of animals, you know, go across the Mara River and start to run in the morning. That's just an amazing experience. Everyone should do it, right?
They should do, Rick. And I think it also answers, just listening to your enthusiasm and talking about all those thousands of animals, I think that answers straight up the question that people so often ask of, you know, 40 years you've been living in Kenya, spending time in the Masai Mara. Don't you get bored? You know, haven't you had enough? Are you gonna go somewhere else? I mean, who would want to? We're living in a photographer's paradise.
Well, you are, and you share that. You know, you're one of the most sharing, most gracious people I've ever met. And I tell this story a lot, and I think the listeners will enjoy it. You know, we were at that little airstrip, getting ready to leave the Mara, right, going back to Nairobi. And a woman comes up and she was so happy to meet you. She had tears in her eyes and she said, Jonathan Scott, you're the reason. Do you remember? She said, you're the reason why I'm here. And you took out a postcard. I think it was a postcard and you signed it and you took the time to do it. And just that graciousness and the sharing that you have for the environment and the animals is just wonderful. I'm proud and honored to call you one of my friends, one of my good friends.
But Rick, you know, I think that touches on a very important thing, which is why would anybody not want to celebrate other people's enthusiasm? Why would anybody want to sort of put a damp squid on seeing somebody who is so full of joy and happiness at whatever is happening in their life at that moment in time? You know, it's a travesty if you don't then celebrate with them. So anybody who's sort of, you know, kind enough and polite enough and nice enough to sort of say, you know, we love the work you do, or, you know, who says we love the work you do, or, you know, we're here because we saw what you had written about this place. That is just such a wonderful thing to have people share with you. And it's, to me, it's what makes the world go around.
I'm laughing because you said work. And you've been around, right? You've been around a while like I've been, right? Mm. I'm 66 this year. I won't ask, but I know you've been around a while.
Yeah,
but,
a year longer.
But I've never been busier, never been happier. And before we came on, you were just telling me all the things you're doing. Sounds to me like you're busier and happier and more as enthusiastic as ever.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think when people talk about what they enjoyed about Big Cat Diary, the television series that we did with BBC Animal Planet, it ran for 12 years, 1996 to 2008. It's still endlessly re-shown, you know, on Animal Planet. You can certainly find it on YouTube. And I think one of the overriding things that comes through that people loved was our enthusiasm.
Yes,
the fact that we just were so energized by being in the moment with these extraordinary creatures. And I think enthusiasm is something, you know, you can't underrate it, because if you're having a good time, other people almost feel duty bound to join you. You know, even if they're in a grump or they're having a bad day, if they see you smiling and happy and having a good time, they may want to kill you. But at the same time, you may just make them think, you know what? That just brings joy to your face. I mean, doesn't a smile go a long way?
Well, it does. And enthusiasm is definitely a contagious, right? And I don't know who said it. It may have been Dale Carnegie, but this person said nothing great was ever accomplished without enthusiasm.
Absolutely. And another one that I heard, I think, in fact, I quoted in one of our two new books, one of which is an autobiography, The Big Cat Man, an autobiography published by Bratt in just literally a week's time. And I think it says that enthusiasm, and don't you love this? It's a gift of the gods.
I do. You know what? I'm going to use that. Because not everyone's enthusiastic.
No, and of course, not everyone believes in God. And when we talk about God, and this is a good little introduction to the other book, which is Sacred Nature, which is like a companion to the autobiography, a big format book with lots and lots of pictures, mainly Angie's, and designed by our son David, who's a graphic designer, creative director here in America. And I think that, you know, one of the beauties of that is that you want to get people to realize that whatever the word God might mean to them, if you just render it down to the creativity in the world, you know, the wonder of nature, the sacredness of nature, whatever your beliefs are, you know, a sense of awe and wonder and the sacredness of our natural world, if we can get back to believing in that, that would really be something, because then there might be a hope that we'll stop screwing up the world.
You know what? I'm glad we're recording this, because I want to listen to this again. that was so eloquently put, Jonathan. So let's talk about your two new books, and then I'm going to talk about your new TV series, and then we're going to talk about everything else you do with your beautiful, lovely, enthusiastic, talented wife, Angie. Oh, I love, man. You guys, you know,
that, just getting, before we talk about that, spending that time on the Mara with you and Simon, your guide.
Oh, Simon Citieni.
It was like when I'm on my deathbed, I'm going to say that was one of the greatest times I ever had in my life. So let's talk about the Big Cat Man first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your autobiography.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, I'm totally honest when I say to people that I have lived my dream. I sometimes think to myself, look, okay, hang on a minute. Just sit down a moment and say, you know, are you being really honest about that? Wouldn't you have rather have been a doctor or a lawyer? No, I loved what I have done. And I always wanted to do something with wildlife. And of course, the joke of it was I went and studied. I was brought up on a farm. I then went to study zoology at university in Ireland at Queen's University, Belfast. And having got my degree, my professor of zoology said, what next? I mean, thinking maybe a PhD. And I didn't feel academic enough for that. And I certainly didn't want to spend my life in university. And I said, no, you know what I would really love to do? I'd love to do something with wild animals. And he just looked at me with that fatherly look of concern, and he said, and do you by any chance have a private income? And of course, what he was basically saying was, look, you know, a love of the outdoors and natural history and wildlife and animals and walking out in the fields, you know, it's like the great British pastime or the great American pastime, the era of Audubon. But it's not a career. You won't make enough money to be able to survive. Well, then I have since, of course, known, and maybe I knew it even then, money is not the riches in life. The riches in life is following your dream. That's where the real rewards are. Because as Joseph Campbell, the great American philosopher, said, who is part of our Sacred Nature book, some of his thoughts, as Joseph Campbell said, look, you know, your dad might say, be an architect, and you qualify, you do your 7 years, and you're an architect, and suddenly there's a downturn in the building profession. And suddenly it's not necessarily the best career and best use of your time or the best way to earn a living. But he said, if you follow your bliss, if you follow your dream, you will have all the real riches that you could ever hope for in life. Isn't that true?
Well, that is true. I tell people the same thing, that you follow your dream and then the money will come later, right?
Yeah.
You have to be happy.
And the other thing is, you don't need as much money as you think. If you want to have smart Armani suits and drive a then don't be a wildlife photographer. But if you want to live simply but connected to nature and to really feel real about life, then, you know, wildlife photography and doing things with wild animal, there really is opportunities there for youngsters today. And I always encourage people, look, don't let somebody else, you know, destroy your dream, because there's a lot of negativity out there. There's a lot of jealousy of people who haven't followed their dream, and they don't want you to follow yours either.
Yeah, jealousy is a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, I know a lot of photographers that are jealous of other photographers, or they, you know, maybe worse or as bad as they try to be the other photographer. You know, Miles Davis, the, you know, the jazz trumpeter.
Yeah.
He had a great saying that said, and it applies to photography. He said, it takes a long time to play like yourself.
Yes.
And I think it's the same thing with photography. It takes a long time to take pictures like yourself. We try to, we see this great Photoshop person. Mm-hmm. And we try to emulate, you know, all these fancy Photoshop techniques. Or we see a cool, an iconic shot. Mm-hmm. I'm so tired of seeing the iconic shots, by the way, of the national parks. You know, they're nice, but I always encourage people to take their own type of pictures. But it does take a long time, I think, to actually be who you are, right?
To evolve your own style. And I think also to recognize who you are. And one of the things for me in wanting to write an autobiography, and I'm actually now just writing an article about why write, you know, other people's lives, who cares sort of thing. And in some ways, it's a great learning experience, because you can dissect and analyze your life and look at it and look at the progression from where you started off as a little kid and maybe the unrecognizable adult that you've become or not through the process of experience and living. And of course, from the photography point of view, I never set out to be a photographer. I was taking pictures when I first came to Africa because I loved drawing. I was making money by selling limited edition prints of my pen and ink drawings. And every chapter of the autobiography, which is designed by our son David, it starts with one of the pen and ink drawings that I used to do to earn a living. And so I was taking pictures as sort of, you know, a photographic record, in a sense, a quick fix to give myself material to draw from. And then I began to realize, wow, I'm in this amazing place. You know, start taking your photography seriously. But even then, I had to make a transition, because as a photographer, I was more interested in recording the animal's behavior. My sort of zoological, scientific background crept in. It was all about what the animals were doing, and isn't that fascinating? And it didn't make necessarily for great pictures. And when I met Angie had a totally different approach. She really was a photographer. She was a photographer because she felt she had something that she could say through her photographs. And Angie's rather a shy person. She's quite quiet, quite reserved. And she always says that her photography, in a sense, gives her a voice. And in Sacred Nature, the other book that we've done, which is really sort of Angie's book, it's Angie's idea, and it's beautifully designed by David. It's a very different book to the normal wildlife photography book. You can feel the empathy that she has with her subjects. And that can only come from years of watching wild creatures in their natural habitat and trying to get inside their heads, trying to become part of the pride, part of the pack. And I think that's what Angie's so good at doing.
Yeah, I'm looking at the cover there. There's a black and beautiful black and white picture of a big cat. So your son designed this, you said?
David designed the whole book. And he was absolutely brutal with us in terms of, he said, I'm going to select the pictures. He said, you can put forward what you think of the pictures you'd like to see in the book, but at the end of the day, I'm going to be master of what I see, and I'm going to reject what I don't like. And he made a very clear distinction between the images that he saw as being part of this book, which he wanted to have something to say beyond the characterization of a lion or a leopard or the landscape. And he said, in a way, I don't want, inverted commas, wildlife photographs. I want pictures representing the natural world, representing the creatures that you're so familiar with. But I want them to be images that when the person looks at them in the context of the design that he created for the book, that they want to look again. They want to go back and have another look. And maybe we've used, again, a lot of them selected by David, a few by Angie, a few by me, quotes which mirror the mood that we've tried to create in terms of this idea of, can we go back to thinking of nature as sacred? But just quickly to go back, because it's an interesting little analogy, you talk about the lovely cover picture, which is of a leopard. Well, picking up on that idea of, to get the best out of your photography, if it's wildlife photography or people, you really need to get to know the individual. You need to get inside their head. Well, that leopard on the cover, to a lot of people will be, oh goodness, did you see that beautiful leopard? To us, it's Olive. It's a leopard that we knew from when she was a cub, and we knew through till the time she was killed by lions at the age of 12. We knew her mother, who was Bella, one of the stars of Big Cat Diary. And in the book is her daughter, Bahati, and Bahati's two cubs. So you've got a whole lineage there. We can do a whole Big Cat Diary based on that element. But it's that kind of intimacy and understanding, I think, that allows us to take pictures that we hope get you right in amongst them, which gets to your emotions.
Well, that's the most important part of a photograph, right? The mood, the feeling, the emotion. Getting back to this beautiful cat, how did the lions kill it?
You know, the thing is, where leopards live, there will be lions as well. So and they're living separate lives, but every so often. I mean, can you imagine anything worse than if you are a cunning, clever, stealthy cat? You know, your biggest enemy could be human beings, but it's also likely to be another cat. And it just comes down then to the fact of, lions are bigger than leopards. Lions are basically master of the terrain. They tend to sort of view the landscape as theirs. They're the boss amongst the cats, and they will kill leopards. They see them as competitors. It's just another smaller cat, an interference, maybe another cat hunting on their, what they consider their territory, even if the leopard thinks it's theirs. And this is perhaps why the leopard is such a secretive, such a quiet, such a stealthy animal, because it needs to hide not just from its prey, but it needs to hide also from man and other cats, especially lions.
Yeah,
it was ambushed. She was ambushed. She was caught out, maybe feeding on a kill, and a lion crept up on her through the. Leopards living in thick cover along by the Talek River. Again, very easy for a lion to sneak up in those circumstances. Her only hope would have been if she saw it at the last minute and could have escaped up into a tree, but she didn't. And maybe at 12, that's an old leopard. She could have maybe just been a little yard short. And anyway, she was grabbed and she was bitten through the skull.
Wow.
There's no happy endings in Africa, not out in the wilds. And in some ways, I think, Rick, a lot of people say, why the boy that was brought up in England, as I describe, my journey through Africa overland, I traveled from London, 1974, having graduated in zoology. Then I had a year in America, which I loved, and I looked around and I loved the landscape, but I thought, no, all those TV shows I saw as a youngster, all the magazines I wrote about Africa, I have to go to Africa. Did my overland journey from London all the way to Johannesburg, 6,000 miles, over 3 months on the road, living out, getting malaria, crossing the Sahara, going through the Congo, and seeing the Mara Serengeti on my way down. And after a couple of years working in Botswana, I knew I wanted to come back to East Africa, because I wasn't a tropical forest person. I wasn't a rainforest person. I love the open spaces. I love the kind of landscape where man evolved. And so I came back and started living in the Mara. So that was amazing.
I hope our listeners are enjoying this as much as I am. It's just great listening to you and your stories. You have lived like an unbelievable life. But people say, "Oh, Jonathan Scott's lucky." Well, I tell people, the harder you work, the luckier you become, right?
I think what I was, Rick, was I was very determined.
Yes.
I as one person, I loved it, this American guy, many years ago, he gave me his card, and on the back of it was written Mr. Perseverance. And it picked up on that thing that you've heard endlessly, and we all know by this time in our life, that, probably 5% talent, 95% perseverance. That'll get you to where you want to go.
And never giving up. I tell people, never give up. A lot of people I know would like to do a book and they get rejected by publishers. I say, never give up. Keep trying. That perseverance is very, very important. Hey, getting back to your autobiography.
Yeah.
Without being a spoiler alert or having a spoiler alert, is there one thing in there that all your fans around the world are going to be really surprised? Or if you don't want to say that, maybe the second thing they might be surprised at?
No. I think, that you're a perceptive man. And I think, a lot of people, I actually had a bit of a problem in terms of pitching the autobiography, because, of course, everybody wanted it to be, the big cat man. They wanted it to be my stories of working with big cats, mostly they wanted to know how close I got to being eaten by a big cat, which was very little. But I think what I wanted to do was, I really didn't want it just to be about the wildlife. I wanted it to be about how did I get through the challenges, both personally and in terms of trying to forge a career, but also challenges emotionally that I'd had in my life, particularly when I was younger. And so in writing the book, everybody initially was getting a bit concerned, because they said, well, where's it going to fit on the books? The people obviously who are publishing it are worried about selling books. So they're saying, okay, well, how are we going to pitch this to the retail, to the bookshops? Is it a wildlife book? Will it be on the wildlife category? Is it going to be on a self-help thing? Is it going to be on a memoir? Where are we going to pitch it? And I just was, I said, look, at the end of the day, I'm writing this book for me. I want to write this book. It's my story and I want to share it with people. And why does anybody want to do that? Is it just ego, or is it because you want to inspire people? Is it the next generation? Is it passing on the baton? But there, to get back to what you said, there is one pivotal thing in that book, And it caused a lot of problems in terms of how to get the balance right in telling my story. But I had some serious sort of neuroses when I was young. I lost my dad when I was 2. I never knew him. He was a very successful architect and artist and surveyor. He fought in the war. He was at Dunkirk. He was a decorated soldier. He was a larger-than-life figure. And my mum, there was 3 of us. I was the youngest. She sold up the house in London and took us down onto a little small holding that he'd bought where he hoped to retire. As I say, he was only 42 when he died. So I was brought up on the farm. But I had an accident at some point. I won't tell you all the details because, you know, I really would like people to read the book. But I had an accident, and it seriously screwed me up. And the result of that accident was, which I didn't tell anybody about, was that I started to have to struggle with all kinds of issues about death and you know, thinking that, you know, I was going to be dying and there was something wrong with me. And so I had two battles. I had the battle to try and forge the career that I wanted, and I also had the battle to try and exercise these demons and get on top of them so as I could sort of heal myself. And to me, it made for a very interesting journey, and I wasn't always the person that people thought I was, and I think that's really what I wanted to bring across to people, particularly to people, young people perhaps, who would look at me as the big cat man and who would look at this guy, you know, sort of 6'2", you know, played rugby, you know, intrepid, determined, and say, well, you know, I couldn't do that. And instead, I wanted to reveal to them how ordinary I was in many ways and how the fact that, you know, I had to take my A-levels twice to get to university. I had to, you know, I failed the exam to get to the school that my dad had been to. I had to learn how to deal with failure. And I think what I was I was hugely driven and hugely determined, perhaps to live up to my dad's reputation. But at the same time, it brought with it a lot of fears and anxieties that became part of who I am. And in conquering them, made me a lot stronger emotionally, as well as, you know, trying to be quite rugged and sort of intrepid in terms of leading the life I've led.
Well, people see you and famous people on TV or on stage, and they have no idea. They have no idea, really. People say to me, oh, Rick, I'd love to, you know, be you and travel around the world. They don't see me taking out the garbage, cutting the lawn, using my weed whacker. I trim the bushes today, right? I take out the packages, you know? Yeah.
And I think also, Rick, they don't, you know, they think probably, they don't think that you have the same insecurities and same concerns and worries that everybody has, that somehow you're different, that you're more resilient or whatever it is. And as I say, if I can just reach one person who picks up my book and who feels inspired to take another look at their life and to reevaluate perhaps what it is they would love to do, or to have another go at doing what they'd love to do with renewed resolve, then that will have been that will certainly, I'll have been pleased with that.
So you worked on this book for a while, right? The biography, autobiography.
I did, and I must say I loved writing it because I was terrible. I mean, I know at school I was hopeless at English. You know, I had problems learning to read and didn't read it, you know, as early as my sister, say. I was terrible at spelling. I'm still pretty awful at grammar. But what I was, I suppose, was I was a good storyteller. I was a good communicator. And I think, you know, everybody, they say, has at least one book in them. Well, I think I found my feet as a writer with help from other people who inspired me with their writing and who would sort of say, look, just keep it simple, write from the heart, write from in the way you speak. And over the years, I've learned the art a little bit of how to construct the story. So as you don't give it all away at the front end. So as you build a little bit like Big Cat Diary in terms of the structure that we use to keep our audience engaged. You know, you want to hook them with some event at the beginning, and then you want to have, you know, interesting things. You want to keep the pace going. You want a bit of jeopardy. You want something, you know, you want a cliffhanger in there. And you know, so there's a way, and you don't, you know, it's nice to think that you just write it and it's all natural and stuff, but you have to develop a bit of craftsmanship. And I certainly learned a lot from other people that I worked with over the years. And I love writing.
Well, and you're very, very good at it. And you're good at photography. And so wait, there's a couple of other things I want to talk to you about. You did this unbelievable, you and Angie, this Canon video where you're walking through the Mara.
GX Mark II.
Oh, so let's talk a little bit about that and then the camera.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we're both Canon ambassadors, like you. Your good self are too, which we're hugely proud to be. And I must say, I take my hat off to Canon, because I think of, well, I've always shot Canon, you know, from the day I set out overland 1974, over 40 years ago. I had the old Canon EF, the first semi-automatic shutter priority camera. Still shoot shutter priority now, because I'm always thinking, have I got enough speed to stop the action, or do I want a slow speed to get a nice blurry effect? So that was my first camera, Canon camera. I was absolutely crap at using it. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I set out on my overland trip, you know, spent most of my money. I think the trip cost, let's say, £500, so under $1,000 for 3 months on the road. I then spent £175 on the camera. I had £30 left, and I bought a Tamron lens, which obviously wasn't a Canon lens, but it was cheap. It was an 80 to 250 mil zoom. And stupidly, and I mean, anybody who's listening to this, you're going to buy a new camera because you're going on safari. Shoot it, use it before you go on safari. Try it out. Don't just read the camera manual, which you need to do, but actually, you know, put a card in there and shoot some shots. Get used to the functions, get used to it, and have a look to make sure that the camera's working when you set off on this trip of a lifetime. I didn't. 3 months on the road, I get to Nairobi, and I had set mistakenly on the aperture ring, or on the automatic aperture ring, I'd set it to the EE setting on the Tamron lens, and it didn't sync with the Canon camera.
Oh.
So, yeah, 3 months. I'd taken all these amazing shots in my head, excitedly got the, you know, all these, they're all black and white, got all these, what do you call the thumbnails, contact sheets, you know, dozens of them. And I remember going back to the shop, all excited, and I saw the look on the guy's face, and I thought, either he's had a bad day or I've done something's wrong here. And he just said, I am so sorry. And I said, what do you mean? He said, the pictures, there's nothing there. I think I had a couple of shots of the Sahara and maybe a camel, because the lens had stayed shut, stopped down to f22 all the way through.
Well,
so what a waste call. That was my introduction to photography. Well, anyway, so let's get back to the...
So we've all made... Well, I have stories where I went underwater. You know, I used to do a lot of underwater photography, and, you know, I'd be down there, and they'd take the first shot. I'm down at 60 feet, and I'd go to rewind it, and there's no film in it. So that's happened. But anyway, I'm looking at the video right now. It's the EOS 1DX Mark II. It's called Wildlife, and the EOS 1DX Mark II Canon. And if anyone... Yeah. We'll have a link in the show notes, but Jonathan and Angie Scott, Canon ambassadors. So just talk a little bit about this. Wow, the reviews are amazing. People love it. Magnificent, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, and I just quickly tell you, what's exciting is that the people who shot that promo also, they did it while they were shooting a 50-minute special on our work in a wonderful photography series called Tales by Light. So just remember that name, Tales by Light. It was a Nat Geo co-production with Canon Australia, still is, but it's now been taken, Series 1, and we're the lead show in Series 2, which really launched the new series in October, which is when our program on Tales by Light goes out. And it's basically us as conservationists and photographers in the place we love most, which is the Mara Serengeti in Kenya and Tanzania. And that's where we shot that video. So that little clip is put together by this wonderful Untitled Films production company in Australia, and we're hoping to do more work with them in the Mara next year, so that will be very exciting. Anyway, so they had lots of gizmos, and they had some wonderful kit. I mean, there was one piece of kit, Rick, they had, which is you can walk around holding a bracket which your camera is in the middle of, so you've got this basically a sort of U-shaped bracket, like a horseshoe,
right,
with a handle either side of it. So mm-hmm. you're walking around, and your camera is on a plate with three gyroscopic stabilizers, and so you can raise or lower this rig. I'm sure you've heard of them. They're available now. But you can get this one, you know, it looks almost like a drone shot because you can lower it right down to ground level. You can raise it up. You can rotate around your subject. So anyway, they got all the new Wismo kits and they shot the show. But the things that we loved about the camera was, my God, you remember when you and I and Angie went to William Perry's Boma,
Early in the morning, right.
Wasn't that wonderful?
Yes.
Well, you know, dark. You know, they're dung-covered houses, like little igloos. You walk in through an entranceway, and you're in the darkness. So you have to wait for your eyes to adjust. Well, Angie took some shots with the 1DX Mark II at ISO 50,000. She could only get a focus because the camera picked up on Williams and taking pictures of Williams inside his doorway. You couldn't actually see to take the shot. You had to rely on the autofocus of the camera. 50,000, it still looked sharp. The noise was wonderful. It was amazing. Now, for us as travel and wildlife photographers, we don't like using flash. I know you're a master of flash, but we're not. We love ambient light. And so great ISO capability. That's a, you know, big tick. Also, for us as wildlife photographers, 12 frames a second in RAW, 14 frames a second. Actually, it may even be, you need to check that for me. It might even be 14 frames a second in RAW and 16 frames in large JPEG or 12 and 14. It's either 14, 16 or 12, 14. Whichever way it is, it's a hell of a lot of frames to whiz through in a second. If you're taking wildlife, you can never give me enough shots.
Right.
So, you know, because there'll always be one which is marginally better than the other. Give me 50 frames a second, you know. Anyway, so that capability. The other thing that was amazing, too, is you've got the very latest autofocus. If it's 61 points, I think, you know, I'm not a particularly right. technical person.
Same here.
But I can tell you the speed of the autofocus has improved, yeah. The amount of the frame which is covered by the autofocus points is slightly expanded, which I love. And then there's a GPS. Now, you imagine we find a leopard, some bit of the Mara we don't know too well. Now, if we're taking a shot and we've got a GPS record of it, one, it opens a window into the range and the movement of a leopard, perhaps that we don't know very well, an area we don't know very well. We can start to plot the movement of that animal simply every time we take a shot. So that also is another plus. So it's a fantastic camera. And also, not everybody likes these rather big, heavy camera bodies, but if you use a 600mm lens, Canon, or the 800mm lens, I'd much rather having a 1DX on it than I would a 5D Mark III, which is a beautiful camera, but it doesn't have that big battery pack on the bottom.
Yes.
So this camera is it's give me. I'm changing all my cameras. I'm having just those.
Yeah, I could see your enthusiasm. And by the way, people know you know from the Big Cat Diaries, so they think this might be Tails, as in a big cat tail, but it's I'm on the website right now. It's Tails, T-A-L-E-S. And I love this. It says Tales by Light from the Eye of the Storyteller. And the subtitle here is Behind Every Powerful Image is a Powerful Story. Five of the world's best photographers push the limits. Boy, you're one of the this is an honor for you to be in here, right? Five of the world's best photographers push the limits in some of the planet's most extreme and fascinating environments. I see my friend Art Wolf is in here.
He's done a lot with them. And you know, Rick, I think what's great about this show was because, look, as photographers, we all know that there's been lots of attempts to try and bring photography onto the TV screen, and you know, it could now be online, whatever it is, you know, in terms of masterclasses or teaching right. photography or photography series. Well, right. what this show does is it's terribly clever because actually what you barely realize is yes, you've got the photographer going through their paces, taking pictures. It's not heavy based on equipment particularly. It's sponsored by Canon Australia, but it's not plugging the camera the whole time. So that's great. You do see the photographer on location in action. You get to see a few of their bag of tricks, but more than anything, it's the videography of the, you know, of the Abraham Joffe and his crew at Untitled Films, you know, this young bunch of Aussies who are technically, well, Abe is himself a Canon ambassador in Australia, but young, very techie, very professional, great people, the best team we've ever worked with. And these guys, a great enthusiast, but they really know what they're doing. So they're bringing the new sort of bag of tricks to the party. But also, I think that they sort of recognize that to keep the audience happy, you've got to have great visuals. And so to have the moving image of the Mara Serengeti, you know, and every so often a little bit of our imagery, a little few of the stills or some wonderful pictures in there as well. But basically, it's the show. It's the videography that carries it. And so it's really worked. And this is great viewing, wonderful viewing.
No, this is like, I can't wait to see you guys in action here. Well, listen, my friend, anything else you want to share with our listeners, whether it's a photography tip, a philosophy?
No, you know, I think so. Just a quick reprise of the Big Cat Man, an autobiography by Brat. That's out in a week's time. The difference. They've done a wonderful job on this book because they've got 48 pages of color and nicely reproed color. Every chapter starts with one of our, and Angie draws as well, one of our pen and ink drawings. And there are pen and ink drawings illustrating the text throughout. So it's a very rich experience. So it's different to the regular memoir autobiography, which normally has, let's say 16 pages of black and white pictures, and they're really lousily reproed. You know the kind of thing. It's not a photography book. This actually is a happy medium between, you know, 80,000 words of text, pen and ink drawings, color, photography tips at the back. On the front cover, there's me with Kike, the cheetah that crapped on me. So that was a good way to get started with the book. So that's that book. But Sacred Nature is almost like a companion volume, which for us is the first book, and it's a big book, and Angie was insistent on this. This was really her dream, to see the best of our imagery, and a lot of them are her pictures, beautiful pictures, where they are displayed beautifully, where the text, 10,000 words of text as opposed to 80,000 in the autobiography, there's no question about needing to illustrate the text. In this book, it's the pictures and David's mm-hmm. design and the way he set up the chapter openers and the quotes. It is, as somebody said to me last night who had a look at a copy, they said it's got a very feminine feel to it, but it is so much more than any wildlife book I have ever seen. And to be quite honest, you know, we've got some beautiful pictures, but David's design made them look just in another world. You'll see as soon as you see it. And that may sound like very cocky and bravado and all the rest of it, but it's said from the heart. We hope that people will love this book as much as the love that has been put into producing it.
Well, I can't wait to see it myself. We're recording this, by the way, on July 29th, 2016. So your book probably will be out before this airs. But we're going to have links in the show notes to everything we've talked about. Jonathan Scott, I was going to say the Big Cat Man, but half of the Big Cat team, right? Can't forget Angie in there, right?
No, and David as well. We're a family business.
Well, you know what? We're a family business too, and I think everybody should have a family business. You know, on that note, when I go into a restaurant and the service is great, I ask, "Is this a family restaurant?" And I would say 9 out of 10 times, I'm right.
Right.
Because go ahead.
Yeah, Rick, one last thing. You remember, I heard you just, you know, give that little tick of approval in your voice I heard when I mentioned the great American philosopher, Joseph Campbell.
Oh, yes.
And to Joseph Campbell, Angie introduced me to him and in terms of his work. And the basically, Sacred Nature captures both our philosophy in terms of our photography, and again, there's photography notes at the end, our photography, but it also captures the essence of our life philosophy. But the reason, so it's a really important book for us, and I think the two books together, you almost feel like you could hang up your saddle, so to speak, but we know that's not the way to be. You've got to keep busy and active right up to your last breath. But I have to mention one thing, because you're going to chuckle about this, because you, my friend, were the inspiration for our foreword, because I will never forget when I rang you up and we were talking after our lovely safari together, and you being a good businessman and a photographer who really is a mover and shaker, when I mentioned to you guys guidebooks, our safari guidebooks, you said, you mean books? You said, and you said, you don't mean apps. And you took us down and ticked off the way that, of course, photography today is such a different beast to it was in the old days when the picture libraries, you could get make a good living out of agencing your pictures, and you had all those, you know, the big, what do they used to call those? Catalogs of images.
Big stock agencies. I knew people were making $50,000-$70,000 a month.
Exactly. Now, those days went, and as you said to, you know, as you said to us, with Getty having perhaps 100 million images on file, the remuneration from a single image is peanuts. And again, you know, you reminded us of the fact that really, in today's world, as a business person, and you need to be a business person unless you've got, like that professor said to me, a private income to indulge one's passion, you've got to make a living. How are you going to make a living? So as a photographer, you said, look, you know, the new mantra really is to build your social media profile, whether it's Instagram, Google Plus, you mentioned these various things, directed us in that way, and said that ultimately social media is your shop window. So then you build an audience, and then you can, of course, get people engaged with your workshops and your safaris, all the kind of things that we all depend on to give you, to keep the bank balance flowing. And then, so we put that, we didn't mention you by name. We just said, you know, a great friend and a fellow photographer, a great businessman. And we ran through that, and then we reverted to what the publisher who has published Sacred Nature for us, and of course most publishers don't want to publish a great big book, and it's a mix of color and black and white because it's expensive, and it probably, you know, isn't financially viable for a lot of publishers to do that. And we found a South African publisher who's also a photographer, Heinrich Vandenberg, and he's a Canon ambassador in South Africa, and he said, fortunately, you know, I know what Rick is saying, and I know what he means. And this is all in the intro, but not naming you by name. But you will chuckle when you see it because you're the man there. And he said, fortunately, I have the luxury, having my own publishing house, of being able to still enjoy the beauty of print. And I know that you too do love beautiful books, but the things have changed. So you're right there. You're our mystery person on the foreword.
Well, I'm happy and, of course, honored to be in there. But I'm actually eating my words too, because since I gave you that advice, last year I came out with my 36th book. It's a printed book. It's also an e-book, Creative Visualization for Photography. And that did so well, they wanted me to do another book right away. So in September, a book's coming out called Evolution of an Image. And I take the reader through what, you know, what it was like being there, then shooting, and then the processing. And there are some pictures, my friend, in there, in the wildlife chapter, that I took when we were, I'm just looking now, that we're wildlife, here we go. Yes, Pride of the Mara is one chapter where Simon tracked these animals, these beautiful lions, the marsh lions for us early in the morning. And I thank you.
And I bet there's the shot there of that wonderful shot you took with that beautiful backlight. And I was so envious and so happy you got it, which was the lioness with the two little cubs. And then, of course, your big killer leopard, you know, the real deal, the killing machine. I bet that's all there, right?
All those pictures are in there. And part of the story that I'm telling is I would never have got, you know, and when I give a talk, Jonathan, and we could wrap up on this, when I show these pictures from that, I say, I'm only taking 25% of the credit for these pictures, because because my guide, Simon, got 25%. Susan gets 25% for helping me switch lenses. You get 25% because you loaned me the world's best safari vehicle with a little balcony off the side, right? And I know your vehicle, you have a super duper new one, but so Susan gets 25, Simon gets 25, you get 25, and I get 25. And I think that's
really... I think you're absolutely right, because at the end of the day, it may be one person pressing the button, but all of the work and the teamwork that can go, you know, nobody really just takes that picture and should get all the credit. And you're very generous to give that credit, because I think to get great pictures, you've got to do your groundwork. You've got to look on the internet. You've got to have great guides. You need a good tour operator. You need a good vehicle. It's a teamwork. And one last top tip for people who are listening to this, you know, I love that 200-400 f/4 yes. with the built-in 1.4 extender, the Canon Super Bazooka. But I tell you what, for people today, my top tip would have to be travel and wildlife photography. If you have only one lens, the 100-400 Series 2 Canon zoom, f/4.5-5.6, that is a must. Don't get the Series 1. Series 2, that lens, boy, put it in your travel bag. You'll never regret it.
Yeah, Series 1 was push-pull, and this is twist. And, you know, it's funny. When I was there with you and Simon, I had, what did you call it, the Super Bazooka? I love it.
Yes.
The 200-400. When I went back last year to South Africa and Botswana, I didn't take it. I took the 100-400 with the teleconverter.
Absolutely. I've got a lump on the side of my wrist there. I've got a super bursitis from that big brute of a lens. So the 100-400, it's, you know, because let's face it, weight is an issue for photographers. You don't want to put your gear in the hold. You want your camera stuff in your hand baggage. So the 100-400 and also take a 1.4 extender, you're in business.
Well, listen, I was going to sign off by saying, you know, Jonathan Scott, the big cat man, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. But I'm going to say, Jonathan Scott, the big hearted man, it was thanks for being on the show, because you have just a wonderful big heart. You and Angie, two of my favorite all-time photographers, people, and friends. So thank you so much, Jonathan.
All the best to you.
All right, Rick, that was awesome. That was amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us on our podcast. We really appreciate it. I don't know what else to say.
Well, let's just say we'll have a great time together when we get together out of New York, and hopefully out of Chicago again next year.
That's right. I can't wait. So we'll put links to all the things you talked about and your new book and 5D Mark IV and everything. So we'll put that all in the show notes. So check it out.
Keep up the great work, Chris.
All right. You too, Rick. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks.